This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane and Company remains the name of the dance troupe, though Arnie Zane died of AIDS 2 years ago. But his influence and absence are still strongly felt in the company's new dances. My guest, Bill T. Jones, began performing with Zane in the early 70s. By the mid-80s, they had become among the most successful dance companies in New York City. They were featured on the PBS Great Performances series, toured through Asia, and won a BESSIE, the New York Dance and Performance Award, for Best Choreography. Jones and Zane were known for their collaborations with innovative visual artists such as painter Keith Haring, clothes designer Willie Smith, and artist Jenny Holzer. Since Zane's death, Bill T. Jones has continued to dance and choreograph. He will premiere a new work next week. Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin, The Promised Land, is set to original music by Julius Hempel and is part of the Next Wave series at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. I spoke with Bill T. Jones in February, and he told me how he developed a dance he was performing at the time, D-Man in the Waters.
It was inspired by a company member, Damien Acquavella, who was very ill with AIDS. And at the time that I was making the piece, in the late fall of 87 and in the January of 88, he was going through all sorts of procedures and regimes and trying many different things to, you know, regain his health. The idea of water was very strong in my mind. And then I had this image one day of people out swimming in the water in very rough waters, and some of them not making it, some of them making it. You know, ultimately it's about struggle in general. I'm very, very involved in the struggle with AIDS right now, but I don't want any of the work to get totally pigeonholed as being AIDS work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it is about struggle in general.
Would you describe, if you could, some of the choreography in that piece?
Well, let's see. If you can imagine, if you will, people throwing themselves into the floor with the same freedom and commitment that a person throws himself into a swimming pool, people supporting each other as if you were doing first aid, life-saving maneuvers with one another, people leaping and diving in such a way as to suggest dolphins and birds, a huge man, gigantic, kind of unpredictable presence on stage, standing like a monolithic totem with four lithe and women dancers with their legs draped around his neck as he stares into the heavens. And there's a moment where you want to laugh, but then you realize there's something quite arresting about it. Two other men rush on and dive, throw themselves in the air, and are caught instantaneously by two of those four women who were standing there. Constant shifting of patterns, people diving in from the wings, jumping off from the wings, music that moves as if it were a movie score for an old Western, but beautifully made. I say that if Mendelssohn was alive now, and he wrote this when he was 16, he'd probably be working with electric guitars and bass. It's a very moving work.
And the people make very convincing waves, too. kind of ebbing
so.
And flowing. I think that works really well.
Well, you know, that's a very kind of dangerous image because, you know, there's been a lot of corny work done about water, and there's been some great work done about water. This is coming from a place which is extremely athletic, and as a result, I think it has vitality.
It's been, I think, less than a year since your late partner Arnie Zane died.
No, it's actually more now.
It's more than
a
year?
He died in March of 1988.
Oh.
Right. So it's now, we're now approaching 2 years.
Oh. So much of your work has been involved with him over the years that I'd like to ask you a few questions about your long-term collaboration with him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that he was 25 when he started to dance, and that was at your suggestion?
Yeah, 24 or 25. Yeah, it's true. He was just by nature a very creative and artistic person. And when I met him, he was just returning back from living in Amsterdam, and he was just beginning to do photography. And, of course, I was one of his prime models. We were living in Brockport, New York, and I was trying to get my degree in dance at the State University College there. And I invited him to come out and try this thing called contact improvisation. A little leaflet had been given to me that says, if you like to do the Lindy, if you like to do karate or jiu-jitsu or anything like that, come on out and join us. And I said to him, come try it. And, well, he was open to it. He went. Before that, he had moaned every morning when I would try to get him to do yoga, you know, just lay on the floor and put his feet over his head and touch the floor. He hated it. He thought I was a cruel taskmaster. But I said, you know, all the things of the, you know, the health culture, it would extend his life and so on and so forth. And in most things, we fought it out, but we found some sort of compromise.
Well, you did a lot of duets together. You choreographed a lot.
A lot, yes.
For him, since he lacked the kind of technical virtuosity that a dancer who got a start a lot younger would have, mm-hmm. how did you use that in the choreography?
Well, you have to realize that we were products of a time that was questioning all sorts of rules about dance making. If you know anything about the Judson Church movement, of which people like David Gordon and Patricia Brown and Yvonne Rainer were leaders, one of their whole ideas was to rethink the need for technical display, what was wrong with the pedestrian movement and the pedestrian limits, if you will, that these movements would bring to choreography. So we were very much influenced by those ideas, and Contact gave us the freedom to understand that there were ways of really moving freely and eloquently that didn't demand pointed feet and turned out hip sockets. So we didn't feel at all fettered by that. There were whole other areas that had to be explored. We looked to the East, we looked to Tai Chi, we looked to Karate, Jiu-Jitsu for ways of doing a virtuosic but naturalistic virtuosity.
So many people have commented over the years on how you were opposites when you danced. You're tall, he was short. You're black, he was white. Did you use that in the choreography?
Well, I think it was... Yeah, I was going to say it used us, but I'm not sure that's too glib. We didn't know. I mean, not that, we weren't total innocents, but like I say in our book, Body Against Body, the new one that's just come out now, there is something... We woke up one morning in Germany, and we were going to be doing our Blauwelt Mountain piece there. We had never thought that this piece, which took a cinder block wall apart upstage and built it through the center of the stage, we hadn't thought at all about East and West Germany. But suddenly we were in Berlin, and that context threw the work into a whole different light. And we were very excited by that, and the Germans were also very excited. They gave us a German Critics Award. Likewise with our physicality. We were friends before we were collaborators. We enjoyed each other's bodies before we were dance partners. So were we self-conscious about it? I think we later began to know there was power in it. But in the beginning, we didn't. And that's when it was most exciting, actually.
How long after Arnie Zane was diagnosed with AIDS was he able to dance? And did he want to dance?
Well, you have to realize that early on, Arnie used to joke. He said, those people who say to live is to dance, they're crazy. He did not feel that way about dancing. He danced. It had an interest for him at a certain point. And he considered himself always a person who would be creative no matter what he did. So he was becoming more interested in being a director anyways. So I'd say, our last major duet was probably 1983. We did duet was part of our work that we did in Intuitive Momentum with Max Roach at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in about 1980, late 83, early 84. The last time he was on stage, of course, I remember exactly, was in Cleveland in January 10th of 1988, which is pretty amazing considering he died March 30th of 1988.
Did you throw yourself back into dance after his death?
And throw is a very good word, too. Yes, I threw myself right back into the studio. I was very fortunate that we had already agreed to do these City Center performances on May 6th. He died on March 30th, as I said. Our rehearsals were scheduled to start again on April 4th, and we had plenty of time to feel the sadness, but we also had a job to do, and it seemed that it was the right thing to do. So yes, and I made immediately two or three new works and helped get a bunch of his works to stage, and I've been moving that way ever since then.
Now, you were an athlete before you were a dancer.
Yes, I was. I was a runner, and I was a sprinter, as a matter of fact. I was pretty good. My best time was about a 9.9 for the 100. And these days, I think high school guys do probably 9.5, 9.6. But for that time, it was pretty good.
How did you get from athlete to dancer, or from running to dancing?
I still feel
like an athlete.
Feel like an athlete, and I'm sure my dancers would say the way in which I train them and rehearse them, I behave like a coach. That's for sure. I love sweat. When I was in the State University in 1970, there was this sort of holy lineage I'd been handed personally from my high school coach to the college coach, and they, you know, there was this real warmth I felt for my coaches, and I would do anything for them. Except when I got to college, I began to become, well, things were changing. I mean, there was always the protest of the period. There was the drug culture. There was this thing called dance that reared its head that pulled me away from track practice. And I had a really understanding coach in college who said, okay, well, if you're in these West African dance classes, then you are working on your stretch and your cardiovascular, so it's good. You don't have to come to practice. Well, little did he know that I was being more and more seduced away from athletics and the macho locker room scene by that very daily practice of going to dance classes. There was also Arnie. He and I, the things that were that my discovery of my sexuality and all this stuff made it more and more difficult for me to be a part of the good old boy system of the gymnasium and the locker rooms. And so a lot of things were happening. And dance won out because, as I often say, there was something so incredibly right about a young athlete becoming a dancer. The abstract beauty of dance appealed to me, appealed to my body and that poetic side of my nature.
What did you find alienating about the macho locker room culture?
Well, it was not emotionally articulate enough. It was that I needed more passion, more closeness. I needed a way of understanding the myriad of things that I was experiencing internally and externally in a way that sports could not deliver, and that system of man at a distance, man fighting man, just couldn't deliver.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, I've now tried to go back and understand what it means to be a man and what it means to love that aspect of men, but keeping the sensitivity and the things I have learned elsewhere, and dance has been one of those places. Dance is a world which is peculiar because it's really dominated in a way by women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important. It was very important for me to understand that the strength and the softness of women and the articulation and emotionally that women can have.
Did you come out when you started to dance? Publicly?
Come out. Yeah, I guess you might say, I guess in a way it was. It was Arnie and I were friends, and I was on the track team, but shortly after we became lovers, I stopped doing sports and left school altogether. So dance was part of leaving school. I went to Amsterdam to try to be a dancer. Of course, I didn't know anything about it, and I was only 19, so it was all happening at the same time.
Was there anything about being an athlete that worked against you as a dancer? Just in terms of like which muscles were developed and that stuff?
Yeah. First of all, athletes don't take much time to warm up. You just want to get out there and do it. So in the early days, I had to learn how to be kinder to my body, to take the time to breathe through muscles. And I think more sophisticated athletes, they know that now. But at that time, I don't think at the high school, college level, we knew that. Yeah, and maybe the attitude too of winning, you know, who the purpose of this is to win, and also something about athletics, learning how to really be a team player. I mean, there's talk about being a team player in athletics, but it wasn't this type of sports that I played. I was a runner, which is me against a field of other people. So when I came into dance, I had to learn in a way how to make room for other people, read their signals, and understand how to read my own better.
Earlier on, we were talking about athletics versus dance, and you said you really love sweat. Is that unusual for dancers?
Oh, I don't know if they would express it in that way. As you know, in ballet, the conceit is that one should exert oneself, but it never appears that it's exertion. And I think in modern dance, ever since the time, I think, of early Martha Graham, even earlier, there was a kind of premium placed on stress and force and the show of weight. So our generation, I think, we've we embrace the athletic quality of dance, and it's, and we share that with our audience, breathing and sweating. Yes, it's not unusual anymore.
You grew up in Steuben, New York, which is upstate New York?
Steuben County, yes. You've done a lot of research on this.
And from what I know, you were about the only black family in that area?
Well, not the only black family. The reason we were there, we were migrant workers. So if you can imagine a German, Italian, fruit-growing, potato-growing community, the blacks who were there were brought there to harvest fruits and vegetables. So there were, I would say, and I'm only guessing, in maybe a community of maybe 20,000 people or so, probably a few hundred were black, if less than that, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I was always the only black in K through 12 in my school.
Oh, really?
In my class. There were other blacks in the school, but K through 12, I was always the only black in my class.
So were you the official representative of your race to most people? You know, was there that burden?
Well, I guess in a way it was. I was very confused. I didn't... That was one of the things I set out to rediscover in my years as an adult. What is my blackness? What is my racial identity? Because my mother and father, when they made the decision, my father, that is, that he wanted to be a black Yankee in about 1955 and to offer his kids everything that the white man had up north, in some ways he denied us the identity that one gets from living in a black community, going to black events, seeing black people and the black church and so on. So I didn't quite know. I knew I was black, because my mother was quite militant about it, but I didn't know how it connected politically to the world. And that's taken some years of participation to understand that.
So you probably grew up feeling not quite part of either black or white culture.
Yes, very, very confused. You realize that when we stopped migrating and settled in this area, I made friends. I bonded with the white kids, and to this day I'm still friends with a few of them. But every year there would continue to be this wave, this influx of migrants that would come from the South. So suddenly for about maybe a month, 2 months every fall, there'd be numerous black people there everywhere, little black kids, and poor ones too. So I had to find a way to talk to them and to talk to my friends who were, of course, steeped in a lot of racist points of view. And I had to, like, sort of steer my way around that, be true to myself, and at the same time have friendships with these people that I live with year-round. It was difficult, but I think that's one reason I'm able to negotiate the art world today, because of that early training. Finding one's identity, even when you're the scenery around you shifts from moment to moment.
You know, I saw part of the contract that your company sends out to places where you'll be performing, and it's the only dance contract I've seen, to tell you the truth. So I don't know if this is typical or not, and I thought I'd ask you. It specifies that the heat in the stage area has to be 68 degrees at the coldest and 71 to 75 degrees at the warmest, with no drafts on the stage area, that there needs to be restrooms backstage that the public won't have access to.
Yes, of course.
You
don't always get those things.
Really? I mean, you have to, like, insist on these kinds of things. Many places that you travel to wouldn't have restrooms for you backstage or a comfortably temperate stage area.
You'd be surprised. We have been in dressing rooms wherein, you know, you're dressing, and suddenly, you know, through your dressing room walks the people who are going to be seeing you perform at any moment, and they want to stop and chat, or they want to ask you, you know, where the paper towels are, what have you. Things get stolen. In terms of heat, you know, the workers will have the back door open, and the wind will be blowing through. You're in a complete sweat from running through something. You get chilled. People get sick, cough, you know. These things they do happen. It's not that we're just prima donnas, but people don't really understand what it is to work with your body as your primary instrument, and also the space that a performer must be into psychically and personally before they can give their best performance. Therefore, this privacy is necessary.
You're in the middle of developing a piece now with the World Saxophone Quartet.
Yes.
And the piece
is called The Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm. Anything you could tell us about the piece?
Well, the piece is really an attempt to come to grips with a host of issues facing our nation. And the piece is from a pretty personal point of view, as a man, a black man, a gay man, what have you. And I think I've been very, very moved lately in working with Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. We've been manipulating it in different ways, backwards and so on. But that speech to me is the quintessential expression of liberal philosophy and the philosophy of liberation. And I ask myself the question, if it worked in the 60s and it could move a nation, how flexible, how expansive are these great words of his? Can it encompass all sorts of disenfranchised groups, be they gay, be they women, be they what have you? And part of that has to do with the question of faith, God. What does faith mean to me, my generation, those of us who have experimented with we've had so many social experiments, and now we're sort of left facing mortality and death. What do we believe? The piece expresses all those things. Also, jazz music and new dance. What do we have in common? What can we find in each other? All of these questions are being asked.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Did you always have the T in the middle of your name?
As far as I know, it stands for TASS. This is one story I heard. And Bill TASS, I was told, was a racist governor of Georgia, and there was a song called Bill TASS Will Kick a Nigger's Ass. And my father had a great sense of humor, so when I was born, he named me Bill TASS. That's a story I've heard.
Huh.
So, yes, Bill TASS Jones.
Okay. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
The world premiere of Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane and Company's Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin, The Promised Land, is next week at the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival. It's choreographed by Bill T. Jones, with music by composer and alto saxophonist Julius Hempel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.